St. Louis Toodaloo, one of the first recordings from Edward Kennedy Duke Ellington, a man who's been called the greatest jazz composer of the 20th century. And even beyond that, Andre Previn compared Ellington to Stravinsky and Prokofiev. Well, Terry Teachout has written a new biography of Ellington called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And Terry Teachout joins us today from New York City. Terry, thank you so much for taking the time.
And thanks for having me.
Let's start with this early recording. I always knew it as East St. Louis Toodaloo from 1926, but do you reveal in the book we maybe have the name wrong?
That's right. It should be pronounced East St. Louis Toodaloo. That's a kind of dance.
How, in this very early recording, you point out, it's not his first recording, but you point out in this recording we begin to see the nascent genius of Duke Ellington. What about what we just heard reveals that?
Well, it's partly a matter of the instrumental color, which is so imaginative and creative, something that you don't hear a lot of in jazz recordings in the mid-20s. But it's also the structural formality of this thing. This isn't just a bunch of detached choruses. It really holds together as a small-scale composition.
And the sound of that trumpet is so distinctive. It really stands out. In 1926, would it has sound as distinctive?
You wouldn't hear many people who played with that kind of sound. That's Bubber Miley, of course, the great pioneer of what's called growl trumpet. And with him, it was really, really dirty. And that was part of what stood out, because Ellington was himself not a formal man, but a man of considerable elegance. But he really liked to have that kind of playing in his band as well, that kind of funkiness.
Duke Ellington came from Washington, D.C., and as you recount it, some of his early bands were competent, but did not display the originality he began to show in that recording we just heard. Is there a moment the light went on and his originality began to shine?
This record, as a matter of fact. It was at this session in 1926 that all the elements came together. Bubber Miley came to the forefront. And Ellington, you really hear him becoming himself at this session.
Duke Ellington, as I mentioned, called the greatest jazz composer, but you write that in many ways he drew a lot of the ideas, at least for his compositions, from his band. How did he do that?
Yes, that's right. Well, Ellington, his real gift was for harmony and instrumental color, not for the writing of melodies. And you don't have to write great melodies to be a great composer. Stravinsky wasn't very good at it. Beethoven wasn't all that good at it. But Ellington also was a pop musician who wanted to write pop songs. And if you're going to write successful pop songs, you've got to be a tunesmith. So he discovered that many of the people in his band were good at improvising melodic fragments that he could spin into memorable pop tunes. And most of the famous hits that we connect with Ellington, not the great instrumental pieces, but songs like Mood Indigo or Sophisticated Lady, are substantially or entirely the melodies of the work of other hands, men from the band.
Did his sidemen, did his musicians ever feel aggrieved at that they did not get the credit for the tune that they may have come up with?
Some of them felt intensely aggrieved by it. Lawrence Brown, the band's trombone player, who's one of the collaborators on Sophisticated Lady, said to Ellington once, very famously, "I don't consider you a composer. You're a compiler."
Hmm. He called his band his expensive gentlemen. So in some ways, he did treat them well.
He treated them very well. I mean, he paid them better, really, than anybody else in the business. He put up with an enormous amount of nonsense from some of the more temperamental, expensive gentlemen in the band. And although he was a bit of a credit hog and sometimes a bit of a money hog when it came to the tunes, he was very good about featuring the members of the band, making them known as individuals to the public, and above all, creating the beautiful, beautiful settings that made his soloists sound better when they played with him than they ever sounded with anybody else.
I'm speaking with Terry Teachout. His new biography of Duke Ellington is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. As you related, his musicians, many musicians really did love him a lot, but despite his kind of relaxed public image, he was in control. You wrote, his selfishness was unswerving.
Yes, he structured his life, his musical life, his personal life, to suit his whims and to suit his needs, including his musical needs. And, you know, this is what geniuses do. They find a way to make the world work to their liking, and Ellington was especially good at it throughout his life.
Ellington told Downbeat he wanted to develop an authentic Negro music. What did that mean to him, and how did that come out in his compositions?
Well, Ellington was looking to find a way to take the distinctively black elements of American popular music, especially the blues, but also to integrate them into this larger, more formal compositional schemes that he had in mind. He didn't, however, want to write a kind of watered-down classical music or a black classical music. Ellington, you know, was self-taught almost entirely as a pianist and as a composer. He felt that classical training would impair his individuality. And interestingly enough, he did not like to call the music that he wrote jazz. He at one point favored the term Negro folk music. And he felt that his music was a profound expression of the souls of black men, as Dubois put it. And I think he was right.
The image of Duke Ellington as a jazz genius, not just a jazz genius, but a musical genius, a great artist, is something we kind of accept today. But you also point out this was very carefully cultivated by his manager from the very earliest days.
That's exactly right. Irving Mills, Ellington's first manager and publicist, specifically promoted him not just as another jazz band leader, but as a man apart, someone who was distinctively serious in jazz in the same way that a Stravinsky or a Prokofiev was serious in classical music. And that was important, especially because Ellington was black. And at that time, in the mid to late 20s and early 30s, one did not typically think of black musicians in that way. But Mills understood that if he presented Ellington in this way, it would be a kind of branding, if you want to put it that way, that would make him stand out from everybody else in the jazz scene, and it worked.
And certainly the branding extended to just what Duke Ellington looked like, courtly, dressed in a tuxedo, eloquent, kind. He sort of stood apart from many jazz musicians in that way, which it could be a very rough-hewn world. Was that a conscious effort for him to be apart a little bit from the jazz world?
It was very much conscious, and it also suited Ellington's own background, because Ellington grew up as a member of the black bourgeoisie, the black middle class in Washington, D.C. He didn't have the same background as somebody like Louis Armstrong, who was born on the roughest block of New Orleans, whose mother was a part-time prostitute. Ellington's father was a butler. He took naturally to this kind of way of presenting himself, and he was good at it, and he understood what its value would be. He used to say, every time you go out, referring to black artists, every time you go out in public, you are representing the race.
Did Duke Ellington get the recognition he felt he deserved?
Well, I'm not sure that anybody gets all of the recognition they feel that they deserve. Ellington did have, late in life, one shattering disappointment when he was put up for the Pulitzer Prize and failed to get it, and it really hurt him. By and large, though, yes. I mean, he was recognized the world over, not just as another jazz musician, but as a major composer. And by the end of his life, he was perceived as having a significance that transcended the world of jazz and popular music. And he thought he deserved it. And of course, he was right.
Well, indeed, Ellington was active long past the big era of the jazz big bands. How was he able to remain so present in the culture after that era had passed?
Well, one of the advantages was that the competition was thinning out. He was determined to stay on the road, to have the band look as young as possibly could. I mean, later in his life, they would record Beatles tunes and Ellington-style arrangements, things like that. But part of it was just simply that they were there. They were out there. They were touring the country 52 weeks a year. They were present. If you wanted any kind of jazz musician, there was a good chance that it was going to be Ellington. And he was very good on television. He looked great. He was gorgeously well-spoken. He suited the visual age that he lived into, so that made a big difference.
The world of popular music and the world of jazz changed tremendously over the 50 years that Duke Ellington was active, and his fellow jazz pioneer Louis Armstrong was famously cranky about the changes to jazz. You've also written a biography of Louis Armstrong. I'd heard this anecdote that he called the great bebop revolution of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie Chinese music, rather dismissively.
Yes, jujitsu music, jiu-jitsu I think music. He said at one point, yeah.
So was Ellington, did he have that kind of reaction to the changes he saw in jazz over his life?
No, he was receptive to it, but not at the price of impairing his own individuality. He always wanted to make Duke Ellington music, but he was completely open to having people come through the band, like Clark Terry, to take one good example, a trumpet player whose sound was profoundly influenced by bebop. Ellington had the great power of being able to take whatever he was presented with and find a way of making it his own.
The Duke Ellington you describe was not very forthcoming about himself. Are there things that you'd like to know that you were never able to discover despite your research into Duke Ellington's life?
I wish we had Ellington correspondence. I wish that he had been a man who might have kept a diary. He was not inclined to introspect outside the form of music. Now, Ellington's music is itself a musical autobiography, a kind of rendering of his inner life and his understanding about it. But because Ellington was so careful about keeping that private life private, we don't know how he felt about it in a way that we might want to. We certainly know about what happened in it. We know a great deal about his love life. We know about the women. We know how he behaved toward them. We have We know what we need to know now, but I wish that we could see some of it from his point of view.
Hey, Terry, thanks so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's been a pleasure chatting with you.
Terry Teachout, his new biography of Ellington is called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And here's another composition of his, Come Sunday.